to Where Brains Meet Beauty, hosted by Jodi Katz, founder and creative director of Base Beauty Creative Agency.
Hi, Jodi. How are you?
Eleni, I'm so happy to see you. It's very, very cold here in the Northeast now.
It has like officially turned, I feel like, overnight. I was wearing like a t-shirt the other night as I was walking around, and then yesterday it was freezing.
I have to move from fall jacket to real winter gear.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I know. The season is flying by. We are already in November, which is wild.
Which means Halloween just happened a minute ago.
It did. I was one of those people who said, like, I'm not really going to do anything for Halloween, and I ended up participating in three group costumes. So I totally changed my tune. I was like in the cast of Hercules. A bunch of people did things from that. I was a Hershey Kiss. I was a devil. There were a lot of fun costumes. And probably the best part was that we did an amazing candy restock at the office, and people who had trick-or-treaters brought in their leftover candy. So, you know, that makes me happy.
This is actually an incredible segue to our guest for this week, because she's an expert in the way that our brains and bodies respond to sugar. So you and I love sugar. We've known that about each other since the day we met.
Yes.
And Dr. Nicole Avena writes a book called Sugar Less.
Oh, interesting. Tell me more.
Okay. So I'm very obsessed with her. I was so much a fangirl during this episode of recording. And I had seen her speak many months ago. A friend of mine who works at Thorne, which is a big supplement company, Sarah Pesky, she invited me to this event. And Dr. Avena was presenting her research that she did years ago at Princeton during her PhD studies. And she and the other researchers were able to prove out that sugar has the same addictive impact on our bodies, on our brains, as like cocaine. So, right. So I believe it too. But now that I've read this book, I can point to my family and friends, like, here are the facts. This isn't just me suggesting it. So Sugarless is, I'll plug this book all day long. It's so easy to read. She breaks down the science into like stuff that a non-scientist could understand, can remember it. She makes a lot of recommendations on how to find sneaky sugar in your life. And, you know, a lot of this is hard. We're around food all the time. We need food to survive, you know, unlike cocaine or heroin, right? You don't have to have that every day. You have to have food every day. Right. So there's a lot of really good lessons in this book.
Okay. I need to add that to my reading list. This is like something that I've wanted to kind of figure out for my own personal sugar intake for a while. So having recommendations in a book like this sounds like something that can be actionable, and I would actually really enjoy that.
So once you start to try to think about having less sugar in your days, and you start to realize where the sneaky sugar is, like, obviously we know like the candy card is all sugar, but there's sneaky sugar in things that like really just shouldn't have sugar in, like bread shouldn't have sugar, right? But some packaged breads do. Mm-hmm. So I found that sometimes I can wean myself off sugar in the same sort of way that you wean off of caffeine, right? It's like, I'll have a headache for a few days. I won't feel great, but maybe by day four or five, I feel fine. And then if I, you know, have this beautiful piece of chocolate cake and enjoy it, my body's craving sugar again the next day. Like, it is just so intense, the feeling and the desire for sugar. So the book is amazing. You will love it. You will annoy your friends and family with your factoids. I will make another plug for the book. It comes out in paperback in January.
Oh, amazing. Very exciting. Okay, great. All right. Well, I need to hear more from Dr. Nicole Avena. So should we get to episode 272?
Absolutely.
Welcome to Where Brains Meet Beauty. We are a career journey podcast talking about what it's like to define success and reach for it in the beauty and wellness industries. We are continuing our health wisdom theme today with Dr. Nicole Avena, Associate Professor of Neuroscience at Mount Sinai and an author. Her ability to communicate scientific concepts in a relatable manner has earned her widespread acclaim, making her a trusted voice in discussions about diet and nutrition. As an author, Dr. Avena has written a number of influential books, such as Why Diets Fail, Because You're Addicted to Sugar, What to Eat When You're Pregnant, and Sugarless. And that's how I actually met you. So these books provide valuable insights into the science of addiction and offer practical advice for healthier eating habits. I'm excited to get into this conversation about our career journey, all in episode 272. Hi, Dr. Nicole. Welcome to Where Brains Meet Beauty.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm so excited to chat with you.
I've been like waiting months and months for this. So I met your book, Sugarless. I say it's Sugarless. Did you say Sugarless or Sugarless?
I say Sugarless, just like you.
Okay. So I think it was over the summer. You were speaking at an event. No, this is the summer. Maybe it was in the spring. You're speaking at an event, and my friend Sarah Pesky, who works at Thorne, invited me to this event. And I was just like literally listening to it in my happy place, because this is all stuff that I didn't have like the science conversation to back up, but always like my thinking. And I invited you to this show, and I couldn't wait for this to happen. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, no, I definitely remember the event. And yeah, I'm excited that you're interested in talking more about this, because I feel like the whole situation with sugar is just like getting out of control in our world. So it's great to talk about it.
Well, my household, my husband and my two teens, were really annoyed with me because I would be reading the book and then sharing factoids with them. And I was like a broken record. And I loved it so much. I was reading it. I was in the hot tub. I do a lot of reading in the hot tub. And I dropped the book in the hot tub.
I was still
able to get to the end. It wasn't like a book I could share. You know, that's the sad thing, because I dropped it. Couldn't share it with friends. But I loved it, and I'm so excited to chat with you today, because your story is fascinating and wild, and everyone needs to hear it. Okay, so let's go back in time. This is a career journey show, so we like to go back to when we start thinking about and daydreaming about jobs, which we're usually like 10, 11, 12 years old. Mm-hmm. So when you're that age, what was that job that you dreamed of?
Well, it's interesting. When I was around that age, which is kind of funny because I have a daughter that's that age right now. I have a 9-year-old. I really wanted to be an astronaut. And it was not like one of those like, oh, I want to be an astronaut because it's like I want to be a professional baseball player situation. I was like, no, I want to go and study outer space and discover things and land on planets and collect the rocks and then analyze them. And I was like all into the science geek stuff. And it didn't work out. I did not become an astronaut because I can't even get on a roller coaster. I have like a ridiculous fear of heights, and obviously it just like did not pan out. But now looking back as a neuroscientist, it's really not that different. It's kind of the same thing. You're on this journey of trying to figure out something that no one knows about and studying things, discovering things and learning new things. So I feel like even though I didn't become an astronaut, I'm still like living the astronaut life in some ways, because I'm able to kind of apply the reasons why I wanted to be an astronaut to what I do now.
When I think about you, and I think about you a lot, like probably more than you realize, I think about how through your education and your research and the work that you do now and being an author, probably every single step of the way, you want to shake people crazy, like, listen to me, hear what I have to say. So, you know, I think that happens when you're on like the edge of new thinking, right? Like you're already there and you're a faster processor and you've been sitting with these ideas and notions for a long time, and everyone behind you and around you, they haven't caught up. And I would imagine that astronauts feel the same way in their research in their world. So before we dig into that whole journey that led you on this path of studying sugar and its impact on our bodies, how do you cope with being right?
So, yeah, and not like you said, like shaking people and saying, I told you so. Well, you know, it's such an interesting question. I feel like what you're saying, like, I don't know, it's speaking to me right now, because I started doing research on sugar affecting the brain and sugar addiction when I was in grad school. And I was at Princeton, and it was like over 20 years ago. And when we started discovering these things and publishing these things and talking about it, so many people at that time, because this is going back to like the year 2000, 2001, they were like, this is dumb. Like, no, you can't be addicted to food. Like, there's nothing wrong with sugar. Like, what are you talking about? You're supposed to avoid fat, not sugar. And, you know, now fast forward, and I feel like any day I turn on the media these days, it's like, that's all people are talking about is how bad sugar is. We have to do something about our food supply. Processed food is really bad for our health. It's harming our children. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I've been saying that for a very long time.
In my business and marketing, I feel like I'm often ahead. Like, I think my superpower at work is being 10 steps ahead. So I've said to my team, I can be right, but I'm not always able to be right right now.
Yes.
Like, I have to be patient with other people or the industry catching up.
Yeah, and I think that happens in science too, because I feel like I'm certainly not the only person who's a scientist who's felt this way. You start doing something, and of course, at first, if it's a new discovery or something that not a lot of people are aware of, you're going to find that people are going to be skeptical, and that's good. They're supposed to be. Not everyone's supposed to just believe everything that a scientist says. So I think it does take some time. I guess I just didn't think it would take this long. I mean, you know, I guess because we have to eat to survive, it should be like one of the most fundamental things that we know about, like what we're putting in our body, what foods we're eating, and how are they affecting us. To me, it should be like the most important thing to study, but it's taken a while to kind of catch on. And I think though people are definitely hearing the message now though.
So I do want you to dig into the research, because the research you did as a student is, you know, was pivotal and mind-blowing. So you decide, I'm going to study neuroscience. Tell us what happened and what you were working on that has been so impactful for me.
Yeah, so I went to college. I actually, believe it or not, I followed my boyfriend to college. He was 2 years older than me, and we've been dating since high school. And so I just wanted to be with him. So now that I have a 16-year-old daughter, I'm like, don't ever do that, please. But I did do it. It worked out fine. We got married. We're still married. We're very happy. But I followed him to college. And then I started doing research in a lab that was studying the brain. And I got really interested in the brain. And I started to see these parallels between, you know, the brain and outer space. And when you look at pictures of the brain, especially if you look at neurons, it looks like a galaxy. It's like beautiful. So I started studying neuroscience and getting interested in that. And my advisor had recommended I apply to graduate school and maybe do a PhD in neuroscience. And I was a little intimidated by that because I'm a first generation college student. Like, no one had ever even gone to college, let alone graduate school. So I was like, well, okay. And then I ended up going to Princeton and did my PhD in neuroscience. And you know, when I first arrived, I was meeting with my advisor, who was a lovely, lovely man, and we were talking about what I was going to work on. And, you know, I had to come up with this like really cool idea of something I could do for 5 years. And we landed on this idea of trying to really understand what's going on with the obesity crisis, because so many people were starting to talk about obesity and public health. But it was still being talked about like the people who were obese, it was because they don't have willpower. And I thought, well, you know, maybe there's something more to it. Maybe there's something about the foods that we're eating, because there's more and more processed food. A lot of it has added sugar. Could that be like making people addicted to the food in a way that's like a drug? And so we were like, let's figure it out. Let's see if we could, you know, discover anything. So we started doing studies in our lab animals, and then we moved on to human studies as well. But basically, really just chipping away at, you know, can sugar produce signs of addiction using the different criteria that are in the medical field for defining an addictive substance. And it just kind of went from there. I never thought I'd still be doing that, but we're still doing it.
So I've never gone for my PhD, so I don't really have any intimacy with the process, but you decide I'm going to go study. I'm going to get deeper knowledge around neuroscience, and then I need to pick like a project. I need to prove something, right? That's the whole point, right?
Yeah. So it's different depending on your discipline, but that's essentially it. Like, I was interested in neuroscience. And so, you know, you kind of focus on a small area of neuroscience. And so I happened to decide to work with somebody who was looking at appetitive behavior, like the part of the brain that regulates our appetite and what we eat. And so that's where I landed. And, you know, in addition to classes and, you know, other things that you have to do as a student, like a big part of doing a PhD is this research project that, you know, again, it's a 5-year program usually. So it's got to be something that's pretty intense.
So you could have landed in the seat in the office of someone who wasn't studying appetite. You could have ended up with someone studying, I don't know, a different aspect of our brain.
oh yeah, I could have been studying like, you know, vision and like, you know, facial recognition or something like that. So it was really, I truly believe that people get put into your life for reasons. And sometimes it's not like quite so obvious at first why that is, but I really feel fortunate that I was sitting in that seat that day because it really led me down the path of where I'm really happy and want to be.
So when you're in these discussions with your advisor, thinking about what this five-year-long commitment is going to be, it sounds like you're brainstorming, you're bouncing ideas off of each other. When does it go from like just one of many ideas to something that you can say, okay, this is worthy of 5 years worth of research? What does that look like in the journey?
Well, you know, I think it's one of those things where you're kind of building the ship as you're flying it, right? And so we came up with this idea of, okay, this sounds like something that might be interesting to look at. Why don't you run a pilot study and see what kind of results you get? And, you know, my dissertation ended up being a series of probably five academic papers that I published during that time, or that were about to be published during that time, that were just basically sequentially building on each other. And essentially that's what science does, right? It's, you know, you figure one thing out and you say, oh, wow, that was an interesting finding. Let's do another study to see if we can expand on that and go further and further. And that's essentially what we were doing with addiction. We were saying, can sugar produce behavioral signs of addiction? Can it produce withdrawal? Can it produce tolerance? Can it release dopamine? Can it cause endogenous opioid dependence? We just kept asking the questions, and it kind of just like comes together in this beautiful package. And I was lucky because I had plenty of friends who the package wasn't that pretty, right? They were trying things and they weren't working, and it was not always like, you know, fun times, but it worked out in this way. And I think it was because it was such a new area that no one had been studying that I kind of had the ability to create it. And, you know, there really was no wrong direction to go in.
Okay. So in most simplest terms, you studied, is sugar as addictive as X? What's X?
Right. So drugs of abuse. So alcohol, cocaine, nicotine, morphine. We were looking at all of it just to see. And, you know, some of it, like, for example, caffeine. I mean, caffeine is a socially acceptable drug, right? I mean, I just had some. But then there's other drugs that are different in terms of their mechanisms of action, and they're not socially acceptable, like heroin, for example. So we were really looking all over the map at, you know, substance use in general, and how does sugar fit into this? Because certainly there is a spectrum when you look at the substances that people use. People use caffeine and abuse caffeine all the time. It's very commonly used, whereas there's other substances that are less commonly used.
So the difference between caffeine and heroin is like caffeine might won't likely destroy my life and my relationships, right?
Exactly. And you know, you're probably not going to have negative consequences from caffeine use, other than maybe getting a crash at 3 p.m. and needing more caffeine. But what ends up happening is that people can develop a mild substance use disorder or a mild addiction to caffeine, and it might not really have any negative impact on their life. With food, though, it's a bit different. Even though food is just as common as caffeine, it's one of those things where over time, it actually starts to damage our bodies. It can lead to obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. But now we're learning so much more beyond that. It can affect, you know, our ability to focus. It affects our kids' ability to perform well in athletics and tests and things like that. And so there's just so much more to it that I think makes it worthy of kind of looking at it through these different lenses of how we perceive substances that are addictive.
So the answer is sugar is addictive, right? That doesn't mean that people are going to believe you, though.
Right.
So you can be a scientist and know a fact, but leaving the academic world and moving into a world where you're publishing books for people like me to buy, how do you actually communicate that in a way where people will start to understand the science and how it affects them day to day?
Yeah. So it was interesting when we first started publishing our research in academic journals, I had reporters calling me up and asking questions about the papers. And I got really mad one day because a reporter, and it was not her fault. She didn't, you know, she wasn't a scientist. She didn't know any better. she just totally like misconstrued the results. And it got published on like Forbes or one of those like big outlets. And I was like, oh my gosh, there's so many eyeballs on this. And it's just completely misstated. And I thought to myself, you know what? I just wish I could write the article. I wish she would have just like let me write it. And I would have, she could have even taken credit for it. So that's kind of how I got into this idea of writing books and publishing, you know, information that's authored by me for the general public, because I was reliant on the media to translate the science, but the media isn't always a scientist and doesn't have a science background. So that's when I kind of got this idea, well, you know, I could write about this stuff and help people to understand it. It's definitely a different type of writing than the academic writing. It's a lot more, I think, explaining things in a way that isn't sort of, you know, intimidating, and talking about things in a way that is encouraging for people so that they see how they can use the science to better their health and to better their wellness. So that's really what kind of prompted me to go that route and to start, you know, being more of a science translator, if you will, for the science that I'm doing and others are doing, so that people can utilize it and hopefully make better choices as a result.
So there's two lives you're living as from a career perspective. You're a neuroscientist working with other neuroscientists in academic environments, and then you are a translator of science, crafting stories to help someone like me, who's not a scientist, understand how to better their lives using your science. So that means you're then speaking on the news and doing more interviews, right? And trying to get this message out.
Yeah.
Those are two different jobs, right?
Yeah. I know. That's why I'm so tired, I think, maybe. But yeah, it is. But, you know, I got to the point, and it's funny because when I was trained as a scientist, I actually have a book I found the other day from back in graduate school where it was like how to interact with the media. And if you read the book, it largely says, just don't, like, let the media do their job and you just do the science and just everybody stay in their lane. And, you know, it's just, I feel like now it's almost become a necessity. And I think it's kind of cool that we see a lot more scientists like in the media, like talking about this stuff. Right. And I don't know, I feel like it's, to me, become so important because if we want, the science has to be explained in a way where it's accurate. And it's very easy to go down a different path and start to make assumptions and, you know, draw conclusions that aren't actually seen from the data that were collected. And so I think it's a good way to like self-correct and make sure that the information that is getting out to the public is actually very accurate and not going beyond what the findings actually show.
So when it comes to the sugar less story, in like a sound bite, since you're in the business now of trying to do that with the media, what do you want people to know and remember?
So really, it's not about cutting out sugar completely. It's about making small steps to reduce your dependence on sweetness. And so starting off with maybe just your beverages, cutting back on the sugar in the beverages and slowly chipping away at it. I really advocate that people think of it as sugar less, meaning just less, because when you try to do this overarching all or nothing approach, which a lot of people try to do, the cold turkey approach, it doesn't work and it can set people up for failure. So small steps is really key.
So I want to make the distinction that when you're concerned about our consumption of sugar and our addiction to sugar and the addictive properties of sugar, this is not about necessarily weight, extra weight. This is about like the body's ability to function the way it was designed, right?
Absolutely. I mean, my kids are healthy weight, they're very active, but I'm still on their case all the time about making sure they're not having tons of added sugar, because it isn't about weight, it's about health. And, you know, although I got into this because it was about weight, as you know, obesity being the public health issue that kind of like sparked my interest and trying to figure that out, it is now really just about understanding how sugar affects our health. And in many ways, you know, it goes well beyond body weight. It goes into cognitive functioning, immune system health, gut health. I mean, really, it's really been exploding in terms of the studies that are coming out with sugar.
So your research and your like literally every day that you're working, the work you're doing might not be received well by regular people on the street who want to just keep doing what they're doing because they think it feels good. And also an industry that's, you know, that sugar is really important to. Like sugar is a very important ingredient to our food and beverage industry. We talk a lot about empathy on this show. So I'm wondering if you can find like your empathetic way in with that end user who just wants to believe what they want to believe, even if there's long-term risk, and the businesses that are built around sugar.
Yes, it's a delicate situation, to put it very, very, very conservatively, because I do think that we need the food industry, the food and beverage industry, you know, as a society. I don't think that, you know, the answer is just cutting all the sugar out, right? But I do think that there are ways that we can perhaps lessen it so that people are not necessarily consuming it in ways where they don't even realize it. I mean, the biggest issue I have, look, I don't have a problem if people want to buy a pint of ice cream and it says clearly on there that there's 50 grams of sugar in it. That's fine. That's on them if that's the choice that they're making. But I do have a problem with, you know, some of these hidden sugars where, like, I just bought breadcrumbs at the store the other day to make a dish and there's sugar in the breadcrumbs. Like, why? Why is there sugar in the breadcrumbs? So I think that if we could be more upfront about where sugar is and what products it's in and have it just be more clearly labeled, then that's a step in the right direction. But I do think from the perspective of that everyday person who might not want to hear this type of thing, you know, it's, you got to hear it. This is kind of like what happened, you know, in the 70s when they started telling people you shouldn't smoke cigarettes because it might be bad for you. There was like 60% of the population smoking back then. And so they didn't want to hear it either, but they heard it because they realized, wow, I got to do something here. This is going to damage my health and damage, you know, other people's health. So I think the same thing's happening with sugar in some ways.
So is it that we rely on sugar as a human person, or is it sweetness? Because then there's all these sugar substitutes, right? Alternatives.
Yeah. Like
what is it that's at play in our body when we're getting addicted?
So our brain doesn't, we didn't evolve to have like stevia and monk fruit and these like other sweeteners, right? We basically detect sweetness in our brain. So it's the sweet taste that's driving the addiction like response. So we've studied this. If you look at glucose, sucrose, high fructose corn syrup, you know, you're going to see the same effect. So it's really the sweet taste that drives the addiction. And so these alternative sweeteners, you know, I really can't say that they're any better. I can say that they're a crutch in some ways for people who have, you know, the idea of giving up sugar is just so massively impossible to them that they really need something. Then yeah, okay, have a diet soda if that's what it means. But I often tell people, you know, that shouldn't be the end point. I feel like we need to reduce our overall reliance on everything being so sweet. And I think, especially in the US, we don't even realize it. I think it's not until you like leave and then come back that you realize this. And I hear people say this all the time. Like people went on vacation over the summer. We went away over the summer to Europe. And yeah, you go other places where they don't have all the sugar. And then you realize how much we do have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And salt too. I think Japan, and I bought something that you would think would be super salty. I'm like, this doesn't even taste like anything. What is this? Because there's like no salt in it.
Yeah.
Okay. So, this book, Sugarless, to me, it was my everything. It was laying out everything that I knew to be true, but in ways that were so compelling, because I know as a human being that if I cut out sugar and then I just one day have like something, I don't know, a candy bar, a slice of cake, then my body needs it the next day. Like it is so obvious to me that this is happening. I just never had scientific proof and evidence for it. So I just, this is like a plug for your book, and I don't get royalties or anything. Like if you have a curiosity about what is happening to your body, you have to read this book. It is so easy to understand. You will be that annoying friend. But I compare it to like in my industry, everyone in my industry would say like, are you wearing sunscreen? You should be wearing sunscreen. Mm-hmm. Why are you not wearing sunscreen? Right. So it's the same thing. Like be that friend that's asking like, why do we need an additional sweetener? Why do you need it to be so sweet? Read the labels, because our bodies just like crave it like crazy. And when you look at the data that you present and how you're comparing it to these like scary addictive substances that we all know, like can literally kill us, like a heroin, you're actually saying like, this is going to kill you too. It's slower.
Right.
Right. It takes a different toll on the body, but it's shutting down the way the systems are supposed to function.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a different type of killing you. It's slower. And again, it's also affecting our longevity. It's not just about whether you're alive or dead. It's about how you feel and how well you're living. And I think that really should be a priority for people. And cutting back on the sugar is one great way to protect your longevity.
So this book, Sugar Less, you're going to have in paperback in January. So that's very soon, which is exciting. Okay, my last question for this part of the show is, in your title, you're working at Mount Sinai. What is the day job now that research phase of your life is over? You have your PhD. Is there more research that you're doing every day?
Yeah. So obviously, you know, as you go through the different phases of your life, you're doing more or less of other things. And so after I finished up my PhD, I did a postdoc at Rockefeller in New York City. And then I eventually landed with a faculty position at Mount Sinai. And so now that I'm kind of more mid-stage career, I'm still doing research. It's just on a smaller scale than it was back in the day when I was, you know, publishing lots of papers and trying to crank out the research. And also, just from a personal standpoint, I've really gotten more interested in helping people to learn about this stuff and helping to educate the public about what, you know, we can do with this science. And it's not just my science, it's everybody's science. There's so many people doing such amazing work that, you know, I just find that talking about that and helping people to understand it is really rewarding and kind of where I want to be right now.
So are the seats switched? Are you now that academic leader that's helping other people figure out what their research focus should be?
Yeah. And it's starting to click where I'm like the older person now. So yeah, I have students that are coming to me for advice and wanting to know what projects they should work on and how to kind of like, you know, pivot their careers. And it's so rewarding to see, you know, your academic children succeed. And I've seen that over the years. I've seen many students go on and get great jobs or, you know, just really blossom in their careers and the paths that they take. So yeah, I feel like it's come full circle in some ways.
As I'm my age, I'm 49, and I've like started to really sit in like, you know, my late 40s and enjoy it. Like I love that the people on my team who are much younger than me, they know so much more than I do. And they, right, I have different wisdom, right? Mm. I have history and I've seen a lot, but they know things that I do not know, you know? And like the language of young people is so different today. I had an exchange in the elevator at work and I walked back in the office. I'm like, I don't know what just happened. I just don't understand the words people were using. Somebody needs to explain it to me. And I find that so fun to be around people who know different things.
Yes. And it's like lifelong learning, I feel like, because I have the same experience. They're learning from me, but I'm really learning from them. And, you know, having a teenager and a little one at home, I feel like I need to learn everything I can about younger people. So I'm grateful for that.
So this wraps up our interview segment. I want to thank you, Dr. Nicole, for your honest answers. It's so fun and such a joy for me to have you on the show. I've been so looking forward to this. I do have a question for you that I really do get like so exhausted after eating. Like if I ate a slice of pecan pie, I will love it. It will taste so good. But immediately I will like literally immediately I will feel like I need to take a nap and I might actually fall asleep. What is happening in our bodies to give that reaction? Because in kids, it makes them go like a little crazy and then tired. But why me at 49? Is it making me so sleepy?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in terms of what's happening in the brain, basically, when you eat something that's, you know, really rich and savory, like a piece of pie, it's going to cause you to release dopamine. But then you're also, when you get satiated, it's going to release other neurochemicals that kind of signal your brain to like stop eating and to, you know, slow down. And so things like acetylcholine, GABA. And what happens is they don't always just happen in the food intake part of the brain. But if it's happening throughout other areas of the brain, it can just basically, you know, have your brain have this sense of calmness and, okay, I just want to relax. I feel good and enjoy the fact that I just ate this meal. So I think that's part of the reason why a lot of times people will have that, you know, the food coma, as a lot of people refer to it, when you eat something delicious and then you want to just sit down and relax and lay on the sofa and kind of just, you know, almost feel like you could take a nap.
Okay, my last question before we move on to fan questions. Okay, I'm a big fan. This is the first fan question. How can your learnings in Sugarless help someone think holistically, right? Because like health and longevity isn't just about sugar, right? There's other aspects at play here with other foods that we choose. And like that's part of this fun game we just played is sometimes you're like, you know, which one do I want to lean into? Is it about sugar? Is it about deep fried turkey, whatever? How can someone think holistically knowing now what they know after reading your book?
Well, I think that in many cases, you know, starting off with like your diet, sugar, let's say, and talking about processed food and just trying to get away from all that, I think it can help people to really begin to see how our environment, and not even just our food environment, but the things that we interact with affect our wellness. And they can be hurting us in many cases. And so when you start to see the benefits from, oh, you know, I'm cutting out sugar, maybe I feel like I have more clarity, maybe I'm not as lethargic, I'm not as moody, you know, all these positive things happen. I think it inspires people to look at other aspects of their life and say, well, if that worked, what else can I do to make it even better? And so I think it really does promote this kind of more holistic assessment of what you're doing every day and how you're spending your time. And, you know, nutrition's part of it, but sleep's a big part of it. Managing stress, you know, coping mechanisms for stress is a huge part of it. Just making sure you're moving, getting exercise, taking care of your body. It's all a part of it. And I think starting with food is one great way to get in there. But certainly I've seen people start in other ways and find their way to food. And then they say, wow, this is amazing.
Thank you for answering that question. Our second fan question is about the world of holistic nutrition. So they're asking, what direction do you see the world of holistic nutrition moving in the next 5 to 10 years in regards to mental health connections and metabolism?
Oh, I think it's going to be huge. I think that there's so much more awareness now that you can do things in your lifestyle and in your nutrition and, you know, the way that you're managing the things that you do to protect your mental wellness. And, you know, it used to be the system was built such that, you know, once it breaks, then you fix it, right? So once you have a crisis, you get depressed, you go to a doctor, you get a pill, and then you're better. And I think now we're seeing, you know, no, don't wait till it's broken. There's things you could do to protect your mental health and protect your wellness right now before you have a crisis. So I really think that we're going to see that area getting much, much bigger and getting a lot more popularity. And I think it's important because, you know, a lot of people struggle with mental health and mental wellness, and you're supposed to. It's a spectrum. You're not, you know, going to always feel a certain way. But I think it's good that we're acknowledging the fact that you can do stuff to protect it. Just like, you know, we protect our immune health and we protect, you know, other aspects of our health, you could protect your mental health too.
Okay, we have time for one more question. This is really interesting. How do you approach holidays that really symbolically revolve around candy and sugar, like Halloween, Valentine's Day? I would imagine we need to redefine these for ourselves, right?
Yeah. So this just came up around Halloween. My younger daughter had trunk or treat at her school. And I was the mom who brought the glow sticks and the stupid little plastic spider rings and like the little notebooks and pencils. And I wasn't the only mom, though, believe it or not. I mean, there was plenty of moms who brought candy, but there was also plenty of dads and moms who realized like, hey, you know, I want to give these kids like something a little bit better, or at least have like, you know, some options here, because I think that there's so much more awareness now around the fact that, you know, yeah, this is bad for our kids' health and we want to have fun and celebrate, but it doesn't have to be about the candy. It's about being together and having good times.
Yeah. And like the candy is so accessible now in a way that it was not as easy to find when I was a kid, right? Like, so Halloween candy was really like a treat. Like my household didn't have bags of candy, you know, and it wasn't a 7-Eleven on every corner where a kid could just walk in and buy this stuff, right? So, and you think about like in the 1950s, like in a black and white movie, someone getting like a big heart-shaped thing of candy with chocolates in it, that would have been so special and outrageous to purchase, right? Now you can find them all year long at Stop and Shop.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, you know, the fact that we have so much more pervasiveness with candy in our society now than we did years ago, it kind of warrants us to reevaluate what kinds of things we do to celebrate. So like, you know, I don't want a box of chocolates for Valentine's Day. I want jewelry or like, you know, a bracelet. Yeah. So yeah, there's other ways to celebrate.
Dr. Nicole Avina, thank you so much for joining us. This is episode 272. And for our listeners, thank you for listening. If you'd like this episode, please rate and review. And as always, make sure you're following us on your favorite podcast platform and Instagram to stay up to date on upcoming episodes and all the fun we have along the way. So thank you so much, Dr. Nicole. It was so great to see you.
All right. Thank you so much. Take care.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Where Brains Meet Beauty with Jodi Katz. Tune in again for more authentic conversations with beauty leaders.